with my daughters, what I notice, and I see this with my son as well, is this insatiable curiosity that has never been squelched. They don't have shame around asking questions. There is no shame around asking questions. This timidness, like, I'm not allowed to speak because I might say the wrong thing. In a classical education, there is no wrong thing. You get to ask all the questions and trust the Holy Spirit to guide us into truth, like he says he's gonna do. And we just as the go, we get to ask the questions, we get to explore different outlets for finding those answers, and there are no wrong questions. There are no wrong questions, and that's their habit and way of being now, and it is how they live. That's probably the biggest thing, and a love for truth, goodness, and beauty.
That's Jennifer Dow, certified classical teacher, homeschool mom, speaker, and writer. Jennifer is the founder of the Paideia Fellowship, an organization devoted to helping teachers and leaders at home and at school teach the classical liberal arts. As Jennifer researched for her kids' education, she embarked on a life of learning and challenged herself to move beyond where she found herself to be. Jennifer's journey has led her to books, conferences, conversations, and other teacher training opportunities like the Circe Apprenticeship, all of which has increased her knowledge, understanding, and love of truth more than she could have asked or imagined. So grab a seat by the fire as we travel to North Carolina to discuss the world of classical education with truth, goodness, and beauty.
All right, so we'd like to welcome Jennifer from the Paideia Fellowship. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good. Can we start off with a little introduction and just kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do?
Yeah, I'd love to. So my name is Jennifer Dow. I live in North Carolina with my three kids. They are 18, 16, and almost 13. And I started homeschooling my kids when in 2009. That's when I was introduced to the homeschooling world. And then, of course, when you start homeschooling, you're like, what educational philosophy will I choose? What was funny is, and I'd like to share this story, is I was so overwhelmed with all the choices that I took a quiz in Mary Pride's Guide to Homeschooling. And they're like, you should either do unit studies, classical, or Charlotte Mason. And I thought it was really weird that, you know, there was an educational philosophy named after a person. Sounded a lot like Charles Manson. So I was like, that's not the one. I mean, I didn't know anything back then. I didn't know anything. So I'm like, classical it is. And that's how I started. So, I mean, I laugh and like that's where I was at. So I started and just started getting connected in the world of classical education and started learning more and going deeper. And about 3-4 years into it, I joined the Circe Apprenticeship Program. And that's where I encountered this intense transformation by being in the classics and reading philosophy and learning about human nature and asking these deep philosophical questions that honestly my heart had longed for since I was a little girl. And all of a sudden, outside of studying the Bible and like getting deep into exegesis and stuff like that, I'd never experienced another world where that need was being met for me. And that just the beauty and the depth and everything I craved was like, what? This exists in another space? I'm so excited. And so I just dove in and I graduated from the apprenticeship program. And I started noticing around me other homeschool moms that were like, I don't know how to do this. And nobody was teaching them. There was a lot of theoretical talks at homeschool conferences about philosophy that were quite inspiring, but can I see an embodied example, please? That wasn't there. And that's what we need. We would never teach writing to a child by just talking about it theoretically. Why do we think we can do that with teaching? That's not a thing. And so I just was really convicted that I wanted to help homeschool moms learn how to master the art of teaching. It's a skill set. It's not magic fairy dust you get at a teacher's college. It's a skill set that anyone can learn if we're committed to it. And so I started blogging and doing teacher trainings and one day a week school. And now we have an entire coaching program called the Fellowship. That's a year commitment that people go through and really learn the art of teaching classically, the classical liberal arts. So that's a brief kind of overview of how I started and where I went. And I know I skipped over a lot, you know, but that's kind of a big overview of it. And I'm still in there learning every day and teaching students and teaching teachers. And I absolutely love it.
So I want to go back a little bit. And you mentioned that you went to the Searcy Institute. Can you explain what that is? Because I do hear that a lot, and yeah, I have no clue what that is.
Sure. Yeah. The Searcy Institute's, the acronym can stand for a couple things, but I know it as the Center for Independent Research in Classical Education. So it's a nonprofit organization that really presences the pursuit of recovering the liberal arts tradition. And I know we'll probably get in a little bit later in the interview about the distinctions between different types of classical education that we hear, because that there are some different categories. They are interested in recovering the historical tradition. And so they offer teacher training and articles and conferences. They also publish The Lost Tools of Writing, which is a classical rhetoric curriculum. I actually helped author the 5th edition of Level 1. And I'm a fangirl, so it's, you know, but I love it. It changed my life meeting that company and encountering the resources. So
how long was that for you? Like, you get like a certificate from it, or what do you get from it?
And
how
long? Yeah,
so
it's a 3-year apprenticeship, right. And then you are certified as a Searcy Certified Master Classical Teacher is the technical name of the certification. And each year you learn how to teach the Lost Tools of Writing, all 3 levels. You also read about the classical philosophy of education and all the questions that stem from that. You also learn how to read the classics. You are introduced to the classics. I hadn't read a classic other than the Bible when I joined. Homer and Virgil and Shakespeare and Plato and other essays related to education. And so they put together a book list where then we dive deep and like wrestle through how to do this. Hands-on learning. It was really powerful. One of the things that was most surprising to me is, yes, I became a better classical teacher, but I became a better human and friend and all of that because of it.
It's pretty impressive then.
Yeah. I mean,
you got much personally out of it.
Right. I mean, and that's why I'm committed to the classical liberal arts, because I see that as what it produces in the lives of humans, like over and over again.
So before we get into more of you explaining about the classical, I did want to ask, because I like asking everybody, especially with probably a lot of parents listening are going to be new homeschoolers. Mm-hmm. But was there a specific reason as to why you had decided back in 2009 to homeschool?
Yes. So my son, who is now almost 19 and graduating and leaving the nest, he was finishing first grade, and I was watching his spirit just be crushed. He's, first of all, like a foot taller than all his peers. He's now 6'8". And so at the time he was already clearing by kindergarten, he cleared his peers by a foot. And so he was too big for the desks, and he would drop his pencil and he would like flail across the entire room, you know, trying to address as though he was being problematic and disobedient, when really it was, he's still learning how to use self-control and grow as a young boy into those things. And I saw it just like crushing his spirit. And I just had this thought that was like, we say we want to raise men to be leaders, but we keep telling them to sit down and shut up. Like, that doesn't work. So what do I want to create, and what actually creates that? And I didn't think it was the public school at that time for my son. And the other thing was, as I started waking up to, I was taking some classes at a Bible college, and they kept talking about the thoughts behind the thoughts, like what's behind this idea and what's behind this teaching, like the philosophy that informs and forms us that we aren't always aware of, like it's always there. And I started asking, well, do the teachers even know what philosophies and ideas about who God is, who man is, what they're teaching, what about in science when they're not even addressing creation at all and just pretending like that doesn't exist? Like all these different things, I was like, I don't even think they're aware of them. And if they are, I'm not sure I like them. I'm not sure that's how I want to raise my kids. So those were the two main things that I was like, okay, I'm homeschooling. And then the last thing that happened is this guy, I'm not recommending this or supporting this. It worked for me because I'm hard-headed and God usually has to smack me upside the head. But he like came up to me after one of the classes at Bible college and he's like, it is God's will for you to homeschool. And then, I mean, he was really strong about it. And I don't, just disclaimer, I don't think that you have to homeschool to be in God's will. For me, for that moment, I needed to hear that. And so that was the straw.
One last thing. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So one of the reasons we had invited you on is because of this summer series that we're doing, where we're trying to like, I guess, putting a spotlight on like some of the important components of home education. And one of those is like looking at the different styles. Although it ends up that I feel like many families end up doing more of an eclectic style of like a little bit of this and that, I still feel like it's so helpful to hear about all the different methods that are out there. And even if it is, you're just taking a chunk of that. Oh, I like that part of this one. But we wanted somebody to speak on the classical education. And I had heard of you because of the podcast that you used to host. And then went to go check out your bio. I was like, oh my gosh, this, we have to get Jennifer on. This is it. Like, I loved your whole like background in classical education and what you're doing now. And then I, you know, just from your podcast, I just knew you were a bubbly personality, which really fits with us. So
awesome. Gladys received and loved. It annoys some people. So
no, not here. So can you begin, you've kind of begun to give us a little bit idea, but can you really explain, I guess, the philosophy behind the classical liberal arts education and pretty much anything that you feel our listeners need to know, knowing that they may have never heard of this before?
Yeah, I would love to. So I think the easiest way to introduce this to people is to talk about the factions that exist, and I'm doing air quotes if you're listening, because it's usually the category that is most talked about or present to people as they're asking publishers questions and at, you know, looking at speakers. So those loose categories. So when we're talking about classical education, there are usually two main camps that people fall into. What is most well known is the Susan Wise Bauer, the Blue Dorns, Doug Wilson, Classical Conversations. All of those fall under the category of neoclassical. And neoclassical education, and that just means new classical, they talk about the stages of development. The thing that makes classical education what it is are these stages of development: grammar stage, dialectic or logic stage, and then the rhetoric stage. And that within each of those stages, there are certain ways of teaching that you focus on and stick to, because that works with the natural vibe of the student at their developmental stage. And then you shift as they move into a new way of being, like in terms of how they're best taught. All of this way was really began to be made popular by a guy named Doug Wilson when he wrote a book called The Lost Tools of Learning. That book was in response to an essay by a woman named Dorothy Sayers. She wrote an essay called The Lost Tools of Learning. This essay has been very controversial in classical circles as what she really meant and what her intention was. And when I was transitioning from, because, you know, I started with Susan Wise Bauer, Classical Conversations, still love them, think they're amazing. So grateful for those experiences. That's what introduced me to, you know, different ways of thinking about it. And I was like, I need to know, what did this lady say? Like, why is there this debate? Why is there this weirdness and factions, more air quotes, because I just don't like that. I don't like the divisive faction stuff. It it just bothers me. And I'm like, why is this here? Is there a reason for it? Do I need to be attentive to this? Is this something that's important? So I'm like, okay, I'm going to figure this out. So I bought Dorothy Sayers' book of letters, her letters, and I looked up everything I could around the context of her writing that essay. And what I learned was she had read a book. So she's not an educational theorist. She's not a teacher. She is a theologian. And by the way, an amazing theologian. Her book, The Mind of the Maker, is amazing. She speaks about education sometimes, but in the way that any of us speak about something that's not our specialty. We have thoughts on it, and we may have really good thoughts on it, but she's not trying to set out an educational philosophy. And these are all things she says herself in her letters. She was reading a book called On Education, and she was really fascinated with medieval times, and she was making a comparison. Like, whenever you learn a new thing, you know how, oh, I'm going to compare it to this thing and try to make an analogy to understand it. She wrote a letter to the author of that book, making this comparison from some things in medieval education to these liberal arts. And he loved her ideas and invited her to give a lecture at a vacation course at Oxford one summer. That lecture is the lost tools of writing, or lost tools of learning essay. So this was the context for it coming about. Later on, people from America are writing to her, asking her to come help them start this philosophy. And her response is, and I quote, like most Americans, they have more goodwill than knowledge. Like she was, that's what she said in response to it. She's like, why are they trying to do this? What is this thing? And so this essay, for whatever reason, was taken out of context. And this is my opinion, and there will be people who fight with me on this, and that's okay. I give space for that. I'm not trying to fight. I just did the research because I wanted to know. And so she didn't even see it as something. So the stages of development thing comes from that lineage. Like that's the history behind it. So then you have, you know, people do that though, right? We get excited about something. We see something. We're like, that's amazing. I love that. And then we take it, we run with it. And then like 5 years later, we're like, dang, I really didn't have all the facts. Like, and then we have to backtrack, you know, or, and then we wake up to it, but it's kind of already taken on its own life. And you're like, okay, how do I adjust now? I'm not really sure. So that's my perception of
is
that.
Is that the trivium?
Yes.
Okay.
So,
all right.
So when we're talking about when most people in classical education circles and classical homeschooling circles use the term the trivium or classical education or stages of development, this is what they're talking about. That lineage. There is another one, and I like to call it the liberal arts tradition. This is what I began to be awakened to when I started going to the Circe apprenticeship. This is also what the guys at Classical Academic Press talk about in their book, The Liberal Arts Tradition by Kevin Clark and Ravi Yan. And they talk about this wider thing. So this thing about grammar, logic, and rhetoric that they made the trivium and stages of development are actually the first three of seven liberal arts. They're not stages of development, they're arts of truth perception. And this is what they have been from the beginning of their conception, from ancient times. The difference is in the neoclassical trivium, they're saying that classical education is the stages of development that tell us how to teach. In the liberal arts tradition, it's a slight difference, but it makes a big difference. The liberal arts are arts of truth perception. They're arts that we study. And by studying each one of those, it awakens a mode of perception, a way of perceiving reality and truth in the world. And so it's not, you know, forgive me if I'm getting too,
I'm just trying to make sure.
Is this too much or too much detail? You can stop me.
I actually had no clue that there were actually kind of like two different sides here to a classical education. Yeah. So I'm finding it very interesting. I'm trying to make sure I don't like misunderstand. So if you say that they study, there's seven components to that. Mm-hmm. And they don't think the trivium are stages in their eyes, correct?
Right. Okay. Right. This idea that that grammar, logic, and rhetoric are stages of development that kids go through is not a thing that they would have been thinking about at all. And in the historical tradition, what they always have been, the liberal arts, are arts of truth perception. So they are grammar, logic, and rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, harmonics, and astronomy. Okay. And each of these arts, I this is how I explain it to my teachers. It's like, okay, are you guys superhero fans?
Kind of.
Marvel's, DC, which one? You know. I don't know. So if you imagine the Flash and he's coming into his powers, like he's a hot mess. When he first comes into his powers, he's knocking things over. He's not in control, but all of a sudden he has this power and he's like, I got to cultivate it. But then as he cultivates it and he's trained, he becomes really effective in life and saving people. And he actually can do something. We as humans are born with intellectual faculties or powers. The liberal arts are the things that cultivate those powers and make us free. That's why they're called liberal, that we are free. The notion or the assumption behind the liberal arts is that I become a free person when I can rule myself. I can rule myself because I have perceived truth and I live connected to reality. And that's the premise behind the liberal arts, which is very different from the idea of stages of development. There is intersection. There is space to talk about development. Like, I'm not giving steak to a baby. It's a thing. And it's much broader. And it has a more elevated purpose. A lot of times in educational circles, you see people making something the main thing that's not the main thing. When they do it, that's when a faction comes up. And it's neutral, right? We all learn at different paces. There's no shame around that. It's just, you know, a larger view. So the liberal arts tradition is what, when I say classical education, what I'm talking about, which is also why Charlotte Mason fits into it. If you're talking about it from a liberal arts standpoint, she was a liberal arts teacher. Like, that's what she taught.
Yeah. So maybe then I'll from there ask, how does it differ then from those who do follow more of a Charlotte Mason philosophy style?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So with Charlotte Mason, she wasn't using the term classical education, first of all. Mm-hmm. So the terms are different. The other thing is, one of Charlotte Mason's purposes was to produce excellent British citizens. That was a huge part of what she was trying to do. She has a ton of principles that apply across time and space. And she was really trying to create excellent British citizens. And so that was a big part of it. Also, she was creating primarily this stuff for schools. So there's some stuff there. Outside of that, there's not a lot of difference, in my opinion, from a liberal arts education and a Charlotte Mason education. If you want to have a deeper dive into why that is, Karen Glass in her, which compares the two, Consider This is the name of the book. And so that's a deeper dive. Also, Brandi Wenzel from Afterthoughts blog, She dives deep into the comparison of the liberal arts tradition and Charlotte Mason. Those who are in Charlotte Mason who say that classical education and Charlotte Mason education are incompatible are referencing, in my opinion, the trivium of stages of development. Okay. And they would be right to see a dissonance there. I would agree with that. I think when we then make this second distinction, things do change.
All right. So then what would you suggest are the key takeaways for this style of education?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's just the purpose. The purpose is to cultivate all of our faculties of truth perception to the fullest extent that we're able. That, like, the purpose is very clear. I think the other thing is it's great books over workbooks. Mm-hmm. And discussion and essays and recitations over worksheets and fill in the blank and tests. So it's much more living in that way. And there is there's a preference for content that is really filled with, like, the big, baggy, baffling questions and that show reason at work. So rather than a regurgitation of facts, we prioritize content and books that show us reason at work. Like, show me Alexander the Great's processing and reasoning somehow, and the way you show me that narrative that helps me like connect with him. So those, I would say, there are big distinctions.
Okay, so you started to paint the picture, but can you paint it a little more on how you would apply this style in your home for these homeschoolers and with their families? Like, maybe what does a typical day and week look like? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if then you can also explain, by doing that, how are you meeting for the liberal arts? Because I'm kind of interested to hear more about that. I don't know much about the liberal arts version. I had no idea that it was completely different from the neoclassical, right? Is what mm-hmm. you said, the other one? That's the, yes, that's definitely the more popular one I've heard of.
Right.
So for like a typical, you know, day in life in this education, like, what are the things that they're doing, I guess, to meet those seven?
Just seven arts.
Seven arts.
There's
okay,
seven
yeah.
arts you're practicing. Yeah. So for the, I can speak most completely about the language. So a typical day really looks like reading a lot, narrating and writing, and then experiencing. Mm-hmm. So it's this living way of learning. So I'll do a walkthrough of my sixth grader. So that's like middle of the road. So it's, So we have a morning time where we read scripture, and we have some other books that we read. And in response to those, I ask her to narrate, just tell back in her own words. And then I also have discussion questions we do in response to that. We also are, we have categories of content. So literature, which includes whatever book of literature we're reading, and poetry. And we read we have certain pages we read every week. She reads them, she narrates, we discuss. There is a way of reading I teach. I feel like it would be getting too bogged down in details to like go into that. But when I'm like teaching reading, what I'm thinking is, how do I teach this mode of inquiry? So like, if I'm teaching like in the grammar way, like I'm teaching the liberal art of grammar, mm-hmm. I'm teaching her how to perceive things as a whole. So I'm going to let her read, or I'm going to read to her, and then I want her to express back to me a knowledge of the whole. So that's like a narration of the plot line. In you know, like, if she can narrate the plot line and tell me the plot line back, she has a general perception of the whole. She's like, okay, I got it. You know, now if I'm wanting to like teach in the dialectic way, or the logic way, I want her to slow down and develop a deep friendship with it. I want her to start tracking things. So if we're reading literature, I want her to start noticing symbols and motifs that start repeating and start collecting those. I want her to notice passages that stick out to her and be like, what is the author telling us here? And with the goal of seeking to understand what the author is communicating to us. And then through the journey of that book, if I'm teaching in the rhetoric way, I'm allowing those rhetorical things to happen. We're asking, what of it? We're like, what conclusions can I draw now based on all this collected information that I've now disciplined myself to not draw conclusions till the end? I've earned the right to say what I think about it. And that's when the skills of rhetoric come in and we start honing those skills. So that's kind of like a broad overview of what it feels like to go through those language liberal arts with like a book of literature. But on a daily basis, it really looks like reading and narrating, maybe tracking things. Every now and then writing an essay in response to it, like at the end of a book, writing an essay, or doing a special project that requires you to synthesize. But that's really it. The routine on a daily basis is very simple. Read, narrate, discuss. And then the more we learn as teachers in terms of nuance on how to teach those ways of reading, like if you're going to read history, you read it differently than you read literature. What are those differences and how do you teach that? That's where the nuance comes in.
Now, is it like, again, with the neoclassical, I always had the impression like there's a ton of like memorization mm-hmm. and recitation. And is it the same with that, with the classical mm-hmm. liberal arts as well, or?
Memorization is still important, but not in the same way. Charlotte Mason actually talks about forming a mental image, knowing things by heart. She actually has her students memorize a ton of stuff, which is interesting because that's the thing Charlotte Mason people and neoclassical people fight over, but they both are memorizing things, which is a different way of memorizing and different things they memorize. The thing, so for the liberal arts tradition where I'm more, and me personally, it's I want my students to memorize passages, poetry, and if they are memorizing facts, I require that they have a mental image of it so there's meaning connected to it. So that's how the what I consider the liberal arts view of memorization. So there's still memorization. We have to exercise that muscle in our minds. Otherwise it's stagnant, you know, it atrophies.
What do you mean that you have them build a mental image of a fact?
Yeah, so that's a great, okay. So for example, here's my phone. If I just put this in front of you and I said phone, like, okay, you know that this is a thing and it's a phone. As soon as I say phone though, there's meaning attached to this object. If I just put it here and you don't know what a phone is, it's a meaningless object. And then when I say phone, there's some meaning. Now, though, when you learn what a phone is for, like what you do with it, you have a mental image. And even if I take it away, you can imagine a phone in your mind and you know what it is and you know what it's for. So there's a mental image and it has meaning attached to it.
Okay. Now, are there certain subjects that you guys always like make sure you're hitting in your education?
Yeah. So it's all the basic stuff. So you can categorize. This is what I love about it. Like, I think this is one of the things that makes it so confusing as there's so many ways to categorize it. It's like, we're going to categorize by liberal arts. No, we're going to categorize by stages of a development. Oh no, now we're going to categorize by subjects or like the ones you have to put on your transcripts, but the ones you actually feel like they should be called. Like, you know, there's a multitude of ways of naming it. So just to keep it simple, we do all the normal subjects, history, literature, writing, math, science, you know, all of that is there. I could reorganize them under the categories of all the liberal arts if I wanted.
Right.
But for clarity purposes, it's still all those subjects. And this is what's the distinction. This will help. Subjects are usually talking about content areas, the content of literature, the content of history. The liberal arts is about what I do with that content. So when I am practicing the liberal art of grammar, I am studying history, literature, and things, but I'm doing different things with that content. There's a way I'm teaching it. There's a way that I'm introducing to my students to think about it. It's not just, okay, read this book, check, we've done literature. It's like, I'm going to teach you how to read this book of literature in a literary way, and then this history in this way. And all of that is what's cultivating those faculties, those intellectual powers.
Wow. Okay, I'm like still trying to process everything.
I'm sorry if this is making it more confusing. If I'm being too confusing, you can totally be like, whoa, girl, like, can you like, yeah, so please don't, well, call me out, like be less confusing. You can say that to me.
What I'm getting from it, what if I understand correctly, is the way that you teach the subjects that you are using, you're focusing on processing information more so than just slamming information into a student for them to remember and regurgitate what you want them to. It's here's information. Now you process it and tell me what you personally got from that instead of tell me exactly what I just told you, because that's the way I'm teaching it and that's what I think, which is typically in public education most of the time. And that's why most people can't think for themselves. Is that kind of the reason that you teach that way, is so that you can take information, process it, and discern for yourself what that information actually means, not what somebody's trying to tell you?
Yeah, I think that is a good way of talking about it. And I think also, yes, that's a great way of saying it, because also we receive what different kinds of information at different times, right? Like, how do I process history information? How do I process literary information? How do I process philosophical information? How do I process scientific information? All of those require something different of our minds. And while we have the innate power, just like the Flash, if we don't have mentors that help us learn how to refine those things and use them well, we'll never step into our fullness. Like a boy is born a boy, but unless he has a man to mentor him, he's not going to know how to step into being a man. And it's the same with the intellectual virtues, these intellectual powers that we have.
Okay. No, I think that helped too. one last question with like the different subjects, because I'm trying to decipher in my head. So like Charlotte Mason, many will follow, like they'll do music study and picture study and nature study. Are those things that you would see also in the classical style?
Yeah. I mean, at Padea, we definitely do those things.
Okay.
You know, art, high content, like high quality content, the finest art and literature and works from wherever, whatever culture you're studying would definitely be included in a classical curriculum.
All right. So you are obviously very passionate about classical education.
Where'd you get that idea from?
And you also began a business following this method. What is the story behind the founding of Padea Fellowship and like why it was created also, like what inspired it?
Right. Well, I know I shared a little bit about it in the beginning, but really, I mean, can I just acknowledge the fact that as we've been having this conversation, there has been a little bit of like, this is a lot of information. Like I can see it on your faces. I'm like, I'm losing them. And because like, me as a person, I tend to be very philosophical and like, you know, way up here in the clouds. It feels like that when you learn about classical education. It feels very highbrow. It feels very like this is inaccessible to me. And because the language that we use around it, it can feel like the average homeschool mom will be like, nah, I'm good. Just give me the workbook. And so while I know that we talk about it in that way, it's actually really simple to practice.
Okay.
And so I wanted to figure out how to teach it to homeschool moms in a way that was accessible to them where they could believe in themselves. Because a lot of people are like, I don't believe in myself. I can't teach classically because I wasn't classically educated and I'm not smart enough. And I mean, one of the biggest questions I get is, am I ready to join the apprenticeship? I don't think I'm smart enough. I'm like, where did you get that idea? I mean, one lady visited our homeschool co-op and she was so terrified because her daughter brought in a My Little Pony coloring book and she thought we were going to like judge her or be weird. I'm like, girl, if you only knew the coloring books we had at my house, like this is not what is happening here. I really just think it's bad marketing. And also like people like me who are like philosophers at heart, we don't, you know, sometimes we just go off on our tangent. And so I'm like, keep it simple. And so that was the goal of Padea. Like, how do we bring the philosophical concepts down to earth and be like, this is how we practice it. Step one, step two, step three, start here and then go deeper. And I wanted to provide those two paths, a commitment to and an authenticity as it relates to the tradition that we're trying to recover and do. And then also a very practical embodied path that people can imitate and practice, both in the content that we teach and like what books we're choosing and like what to do first, second, and third and scheduling, like all those kinds of things, but then also how to teach this way. Because the truth is, and I'll just be frank, a liberal arts education, if you're going to give that to your kids, there is more required of you. We can't just say, okay, here's your workbook, fill that out, you're done, you've learned. Like that's right. Not, it requires somebody who takes seriously to like learning how to teach. That doesn't mean it's going to take all their, you know, all their time, but it is a mindset shift that I am a teacher and I take seriously my craft. Like this is my job. I'm a homeschool mom and I'm going to, you know, pour into myself. I'm going to enroll my husband in pouring into me and investing in how, like, you know, like these are all things that if we are, that's a shift in mindset because it's not natural. We're not born knowing how to do this. And I wanted to provide a space that was specifically for homeschool moms to learn how to do this with ease in an affordable way that actually worked for how they lived a life. Yeah. So we have an online academy for 7th through 12th graders, because sometimes when we choose to classically educate, the choice includes, you know what? I don't have the time and space to learn how to teach this. So let me outsource it. Mm-hmm. No shame there. It takes a village. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Or you know what? I'm all about this and I'm ready to invest the time to learn how to teach this. So then they start in the fellowship, which is the coaching program and where they start learning. And maybe they just choose to spend an entire year learning how to teach literature. And so then they outsource the other things or use workbook curriculum for the other things that they're not ready yet. And then there's this grace and space to like add things as you learn. So I help show them a path, a shame-free path that's not this highbrow, ivory tower vibe to approach this. And while we're on the topic of highbrow, ivory tower vibes, like also, you know, it doesn't have to be all Eurocentric and European and whitewashed. Like, this works for any culture. It doesn't have to mean just old dead white guys. Like, this, because it's about skills and processing, you can use content, the best content from any nation that you would choose to, if, you know, for whatever your family's priorities are.
I think it's great that you pointed that out, because that was another thing that I always thought, that like, it had to be like the great, only the great philosophers were being studied. And I think it's important that you bring out that it can be applied to really any great stories of history.
Yeah. I mean, if the liberal arts are arts of truth perception and not subjects, then it gets to be that. Mm-hmm. Yes, it gets to also be the highest quality literature from those different nations.
Right.
But yeah, there are people who would disagree with me on that. I now, that is one I don't align with. That I don't think that's true.
So is any of it in person, or it's all online, your classes and your coaching? Mm-hmm. And
so it was in person, and then COVID, and then we brought the academy online. So I do go to, like, sometimes co-ops or schools want me to take on their teacher training for them. And so I'll go to co-ops and, like, we'll make a day or a weekend of it, and I'll do all the teacher training for them so I can train their teachers or their moms who are teaching, or, like, you know, I always call homeschool mom teachers. I think it's a respect thing and a dignity thing that that is what you're doing. And so I want to honor homeschool moms as teachers. So I'll train teachers, and that way the director can just be about the logistics, and she doesn't have to stress about, I don't know how to train them in this. I'm like, I got you. So I do that in person and online.
What do you call homeschool dads?
Homeschool dads?
Teachers as well?
I do not. I call them dads. The husbands, the men. Unless they're teaching, then they can be teachers.
We just interviewed a guy. He's a homeschool dad. He said it was tough. It was tough being in the circle because there's not many of them. They get left out a lot.
I call you guys let's call you the gatekeepers. You're like the gatekeepers. Like, you will not pass, or we'll let you in.
That's great. I like that title. How have you seen your kids benefit from this now that you have one that's about to graduate and has been using this since what, first grade, you said?
Yeah. So it's been interesting because I think I saw the biggest difference so part of my story is I unexpectedly and kind of tragically became a single mom 3 years ago. That was not part of my plan. And one of the results of that is I decided to put my high schoolers in school. And that was really hard. That's another interview though. And when that transition happened, that's when I saw, like, the effect that it really had on them, because especially my son, he went in and I was kind of thinking about this for him anyway, because he was playing sports at an elite level. Like, he's being recruited by D1 colleges. And so it was hard to do that and be a homeschooler the older he got. And he's like, Mom, I'm not actually learning anything. Like, you did school with me. They're just like, I'm like learning how to live in the system. And while it was sad, I was like he knew the difference. And then he had this one project in one of his English classes where he had to design a school. Guess what kind of school he designed? A liberal arts sports emphasis, of course, school. But he knew what learning was. Like, he could feel the difference. Like, you can't ever take that away from him. He knows what it feels like to learn, and he's not satisfied with himself unless he touches that, which also is frustrating. Like, he gets to learn a new skill set now. How do you deal with a situation when you have a teacher that's not actually helping you learn, and then you take the reins yourself, which is not a skill he learned with me. I was always leading in this way of actually learning. So now he's like in a system, having to learn how to be in a system, which, by the way, actually produced some good results. But now he's like, how do I man up and take the reins of my own education when other people aren't holding my hand. And that was a really powerful experience for him, deciding what kind of man and student he wanted to be. And so that's one way that I saw it with my son, especially with my daughters. What I notice, and I see this with my son as well, is this insatiable curiosity that has never been squelched. They don't have shame around asking questions. There is no shame around asking questions. This timidness, like, I'm not allowed to speak because I might say the wrong thing. In a classical education, there is no wrong thing. You get to ask all the questions and trust the Holy Spirit to guide us into truth, like he says he's going to do. And we just go. We get to ask the questions. We get to explore different outlets for finding those answers. And there are no wrong questions. There are no wrong questions. And that's their habit and way of being now. And it is how they live. That's probably the biggest thing. And a love for truth, goodness, and beauty. They know trash literature versus they're like, I know it's trash, but I still kind of like it. But at least they know. They're like, but this is actually better. Like, their bookshelves have, you know, the good stuff on it too. And they also know how to listen and come outside themselves and be slow with an idea. They know how to contemplate. That's what I've seen.
Wow, I'm so glad I asked that. What a beautiful testimony of your kids. And I think that it's just so neat that, yeah, that you prepared him, even at a high school level, he could go into the system. Because if they choose to go to college, that is a system. Mm-hmm. But already he was prepared at the high school level to go in there and realize that, yeah, we're just learning how to survive the system. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's, oh gosh, I have so much to say about that. I know that's another episode. I'm going to use my self-control.
But that's pretty incredible. That says a lot about, I feel like that says a lot about home education in itself and and preparing our kids for living in the world. And again, I don't think that we're sheltering them. I think that we're doing them a good service to be able to stand on their 2 feet for life. Right. And he's already getting there at the high school level. That's amazing.
Yeah. Now he's moving out in like a couple months.
Oh,
like,
no.
What? So many feelings.
Oh boy. Did he choose his college yet?
So he's going to prep school for this next year because of COVID, but the NCAA made some weird decisions about how freshmen could come into colleges. So it's basically leaving almost zero spots for freshmen for scholarships. And so he's going to a prep school for a year, which is like an in-between, which I'm actually really excited about because it's like he's away from home, but it's still a family environment. He'll still be like eating around the dinner table with like an authority figure there, but it's not me. So I actually love this transition even more than straight to college. So, but yeah, he just committed full scholarship. He committed last week, you know, to this prep school. And so we're really excited to have a decision made.
That is exciting. Congrats to you, him and your family.
I'm just, this is a shot in the dark, but basketball?
Yes, okay. Basketball. Yeah, he played basketball and football, but basketball is his thing. I know. So 6'8", hard to. I actually wouldn't let him play ball for a while because I'm like, because you're tall, everyone's going to expect you to. I'm like, what if you want to be a photographer? We're going to give space for that. And then finally.
Yeah, weird angle. Here's a photographer. Yeah.
He's like, no, this is what I want to do. I'm like, okay, as long as it's your choice and I'm not pushing it.
That's great. That's awesome, Jennifer. All right. So as you had pointed out, when I think of classical education, I do think of rigorous and daunting and very uppity. So what advice do you have for the parent wanting to get started with this method to help them avoid getting that overwhelm? Like, where do they even begin?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what I recommend is just choosing as close to a curriculum in the box kind of thing that you can to begin with and follow it precisely. Just go through the motions, do the thing, and choose one book at a time to always be reading or some personal development thing for your teaching to always be into to progressively get more into the nuance. And as you learn more, shifting things as you see how to. Mm-hmm. So my rule is, unless I can explain to you why I need to do something differently, I'm not going to do something differently. because that's just that inconsistency in rat race just doesn't serve anyone. Mm-hmm. So like Memoria Press has the most complete curriculum in a box kind of situation. Also Classical Academic Press, they have pretty much everything except for math patterned out for people as well. You could just say, okay, we're going to do all these things, but those are, and then you also have something like Classical Conversations. You also have the Alvieri, and you also have, which is more is like from the Charlotte Mason side, and then Ambleside Online. That's what my family used for the longest time. And we started shifting things fifth through 12th grade, and Hedaya, we have stuff too, actually. So all of those are places you can go to get like a download of what do I choose? What do I start with? Let's go. And then find your, the first book I would suggest is The Liberal Arts Tradition by Clark and Yon. For your, okay, let me start learning more. Okay. And choose your curriculum in a box, and then choose your continuing education, and just keep working those and make adjustments as you see and as you see fit and as you continue to go. And all the other voices that are telling you what you should do, ignore them. And if you feel shame, then run from whatever is making you feel that way. Like that, I think, are important rules is, there gets to be a free space to learn and evolve, and it doesn't have to be perfect, because by the way, it never is.
No, I think that's great. And I've said that before, that there is no shame in starting off with more of a structured or box curriculum, even if it is a certain style, because you have to start somewhere, and it is very overwhelming when you just like make the decision to homeschool.
Right.
And to have that structure, I feel like helps at the beginning. And most of us, like you said, you just start to like, okay, let go of this and plug in this and let go of that. And then like, you find your way. And even we just interviewed somebody for unschooling. Mm-hmm. She said the same thing. She said that she started off with, like me, the check boxes and the timer of her classes. Cause you know, we were still in the whole like, that was me too. Before you go through the de-schooling process of like, what really is education here? Hold up.
So, yeah. But I printed out the state standards.
Yes. Yes. She was like, I started off that way. And as I began to, like you said, your personal development, professional development as a parent, like as you read up more and look into more and you realize what you really want for your family, then you start to like kind of let go and piece your way into that. And, you know, I wouldn't have thought that I just didn't think that she would have been the same thing at the beginning, like the checkbox mom. Mm-hmm. She said she was, and it was just like a slow progression into unschooling. And then now they're like full blown unschooling.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. And I think like, you know, if you're just starting out homeschooling, just, you know, and you want to do classical, go with one of those. But if you're already doing something and want to shift more into a classical or liberal arts or Charlotte Mason way, just do a little bits by little bits. Stay with what you're doing. Don't make any changes. And then start the continuing education thing and choose one thing at a time. Even in my fellowship with the coaching program, we have different modules. Like we have like how to teach literature, how to teach history. We have like all the things, but I suggest they only choose one to focus on for every 3 months to a year. Preferably a year. Choose one thing to commit to cultivating for that year, because it takes that long to learn a new skill. And that's okay. That's how we learn as humans.
Yep. Right. So I know that our thoughts on education and learning have changed quite a bit since we began, like we just said, used to be the checkbox mom. So how has your own philosophy on education morphed and changed over time?
Yeah. So probably the biggest thing is I've become more relaxed and less anxious and less controlling. I was very, and so this is where I feel like my own sanctification and personal development has intersected with my practice of teaching. And I can't even tell the difference between the two anymore. Teaching is just an excuse to be sanctified. That's how I see it now. And so I was really consumed with fear for a very long time. So much so that it was just captivating to me. There were sometimes it was so bad that, I mean, just nauseous level fear, you know, and like, you know, and I also got to learn other mindset things, just relaxing and knowing that, first of all, I can't control anything. I can't control my kids. If I think I can, that is an illusion. That's not a thing. I can guide them. I can coach them. I can invite them, but I can't control them. They are going to be the humans they are. And by the way, there was only one perfect parent and literally all of his children rebelled. So we're, you know, just releasing the shame. I'm so big about shame-free because those shame-driven narratives of what I'm supposed to do guided me for so long. And it produced so much anxiety and stress in my home. It wasn't fair to my family. It wasn't fair to my kids. Nobody can live up to that standard. And so our tagline, and this it really embodies how I changed, is expanding wisdom, extending grace. The ideal will always be the ideal. It's there. It's something we want to keep reaching for. But the real is a thing, and I get to acknowledge it and live within the limits of creaturely life and hold those two things in tension. And so the biggest way that I've changed is learning to hold tension for those two things, the real and the ideal. Every day, holding that tension, learning how to hold that tension with more skill and grace as I get older and more experienced.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. I feel like that's really encouraging, and many, many parents are going to need to hear that and be reminded of that. Well, we think community is also a key player in all of this home education, however it may look, however the community aspect looks. So what has been the significance of community to you on this journey?
Yeah, so that we really just learn in community. Like, you know, I can't separate my thoughts on community from like my religious views. You know, I believe we're made in the image of a triune God. And at our very core, we're communal. We're three in one. Like in the way we were woven together, we're communal. And we need that to flourish. We need that to learn. It's a non-negotiable. Like it has to be there or we're not going to flourish as human beings. And so when it comes to teaching, like, I need to hear what you think. I need to hear what you think. You know, like, I need to hear what both of you think. I need to hear what my neighbor thinks. Like, we have the mind of Christ, not me by myself. We, as a whole people, have the mind of Christ collectively. And I need all the things. I need all the perspectives. And it keeps me humble. Because if I'm just over in my little cave, you know, typing away, reading away, I can think I'm pretty awesome when, you know, I'm like, actually, I didn't know very much at all. So it keeps us humble. It keeps us flourishing. And then it just makes it more fun. Like, we're celebratory beings, you know, we're ceremonial beings, celebration and festival and like the joy of life happens with people. All of those are ingredients to, I think, a really healthy education.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you that because I had listened to one of your interviews and you had mentioned how, you know, you were part of a co-op previously and you needed to figure out something different. And it was basically, I believe the premises of your Padea fellowship, but you had said that like you needed community and you like needed somebody to like hold you accountable at that stage of homeschooling you were
in. Yes, that too.
And didn't you start in like a garage at first, mm-hmm. like with a couple other mm-hmm. families just to have that?
Yes. Yeah. Because like, I don't know if you guys are Enneagram fans, but I'm a 7 on the Enneagram and I am all over the place. And
I'm just personality like, quiz.
But I am all over the place and I definitely am better when I have somebody holding me accountable. I just do better.
Share that. I also love that, you know, then you needed something and you created it yourself, you know,
hey, right.
There's a need. Let's create it. All right. We are down to the last two questions.
Okay.
So if you could hand a book to every new person that you met, what book would it be?
Reaching Out by Henry Nguyen, Reaching Out, the Three Movements of the Spiritual Life. It is my handbook for living, teaching, loving, being in relationship. I think, and this is why, out of all the things that we could learn about how to teach, learning to step into new ways of beings is by far the most powerful thing that will get us to the results we want. It doesn't matter how precise and amazing my plans are, if my way of being, the way I show up in the world, isn't in alignment with the results I want to create. For example, if I want curious kids, if I am not curious, guess what? I'm not going to produce that result. And so Reaching Out talks about these ways of being that I feel like are just amazing for life, but are the ways of being that produce the kind of thinkers and learners and teachers that we, that create what we say we want to create. I think it's the biggest thing that creates it.
Great. And then the final question is, if you knew you could only leave one last piece of wisdom for your children, what would it be?
Risk unapologetically with no shame. Take risks unapologetically with no shame.
That is a great way to end it, Jennifer. So where can people find you?
So you can find me at Paideia Fellowship. That's Paideia Fellowship.com. I'm also at that handle on Instagram. You can also find me, follow me, my personal Instagram, Jennifer R. Dow. And then I'm on Facebook as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for joining us today and for helping to explain the whole classical side of education. And our listeners can go to your website for more resources and more help, which is great. So they can get connected with you if need be.
Yes.
It was a pleasure getting to know you. So thank you again for giving us your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
We want to thank Jennifer for joining us today. She brings such knowledge and passion for the classical liberal arts education. We also want to thank all of you for joining us around the campfire today, as well as those of you who continue to join us each and every week. If you have been enjoying our podcast, please be sure to follow us on your podcast app and write a review. We would also love for you to connect with us on social media or send us an email. And if you're new to homeschooling, send us an email to receive your free Getting Started packet. We hope you have an amazing week, and as always, let's light a fire they can't put out.